Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The 2014 Winter Olympic Games begin in just 10 days in the Russian Black Sea resort town of Sochi. We've heard reports about the extraordinary cordon of security that will surround the Games. It's clear that President Vladimir Putin is well aware that the country's standing, as well as his own reputation, are on the line.
Masha Gessen is a prominent Russian-American journalist, and she's the author who's written extensively and critically about President Putin. Her latest book is called Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and is no less critical. It tells the story of the female punk rockers who paid a heavy price for their political activism, spending almost 2 years in jail in Putin's Russia.
Masha Gessen will be speaking this evening at Brandeis University, and she joins us now. And welcome to the program, Masha Gessen. Great to meet you. Thanks for coming
in. Thank you. Great to be here.
So I want to talk about your book in a moment, but first I want to ask you about Sochi, because you investigated some of the construction work taking place in the lead up to the games there. What did you find?
Well, my work was very early on. It was about 3 years ago. And what I found was what has been now very well documented by Alexei Navalny, the anti-corruption activist who released his report yesterday, which shows that everything that has been built over budget and over market price significantly. And most of the contracts have been awarded to Putin's cronies, and at least 30% of the money has gone to offshore accounts, and it's not clear who it's gone to. And it appears that the federal budget has subsidized the corruption that has passed as construction to a far greater extent than anyone had realized.
And I've read, and I think I've heard you talk about this, that when you talk about the corruption, just getting in there to do the reporting is quite dangerous in and of itself, right? I mean, this is pretty serious corruption.
There was a period when I think Sochi was the most dangerous assignment in Russia, more dangerous than Chechnya or Dagestan. And in fact, my main source on my Sochi stories was somebody who had done construction projects in Sochi, and I had asked him to take me to Sochi and sort of walk me through some of the projects he had done and show me what had been stolen. And he said, he's not going. He said, you know, I set foot there, I get killed. Soon after that, he became a political refugee.
So give me a sense of how people in Russia are experiencing or thinking about the build-up to the Olympics. Is there any sort of Olympic fever there?
Well, if there's any Olympic fever, it's not among anybody I know. I think a lot of people are concerned about what happens after the Olympics. It's very clear that the crackdown will intensify, that Putin has tried to make some moves to sort of varnish his image in the lead-up to the Olympics, some very limited moves, but still significant for the people whom it's affected, including the two Pussy Riot members who were released from jail. You know, he knocked a whopping 2 months off of their sentences. Mikhail Khodorkovsky and his business partner Platon Lebedev, who were released after more than 10 years in jail. The 30 Greenpeace activists who were kidnapped in September in international waters were released. But there's still dozens of people who are in jail, many of them awaiting trial. And it's likely that those sentences will be extremely harsh, in part to sort of retaliate for the concessions that he feels he's had to make.
Well, let me ask you about Pussy Riot. As you mentioned, the two members that were imprisoned were released. They say they'll continue their protests against Putin now that they're out of jail. What do you think the future holds for them? I mean, you know, what's the future after the Olympics?
Well, they've undergone an amazing transformation. When they went in, they were basically college students who had staged a brilliant and wonderful prank, but it was a prank that they didn't expect to get 2 years of jail time for. When they came out, they were seasoned political prisoners and seasoned political activists, and they have launched a prisoners' rights movement. And they're very impressive in the way they're going about it, their energy and their organizing acumen, and what they have been able to document so far in terms of human rights abuses in the prisons. Now, that's a really dangerous line of work. That's probably the most dangerous work there is in Russia right now, is to be an outspoken political activist. So I'm worried for them.
You were the only reporter allowed to interview one of the band members. That was Nadezhda Tolokonikova in prison. What was that experience like? I mean, what did you see?
It's not that I was the only reporter allowed to document her, basically, to interview her. I was actually one of her friends ceded his place in a short visit. They're allowed one four-hour visit every 2 months with a friend or relative, and one a conjugal visit every 3 months. So I was lucky enough to elbow my way into one of those short visits. It was an amazing experience. We sat in a tiny room for the 4 hours. She tried to sort of reconnect with her daughter, who was 5 years old at the time, who still is 5 years old, actually. They hadn't seen each other in 2 months. That's a very long time for a five-year-old child. So they were going through this very awkward emotional business of trying to reconnect while I was also interviewing her, while her husband was also sort of trying to have some sort of connection. And there was a guard looking on the entire time. So the subjects we could discuss were somewhat limited. But at the time, I thought she was sort of slipping into depression. She was very reluctant to talk about certain things. She did not want to pursue any complaints about the conditions in the prison. And as it turned out, she was in a very desperate place at the time, trying to figure out how she could possibly protest anything without making life worse for other inmates and putting herself in danger. She finally figured that out a couple of months later.
Mm. I'd like to ask you a little bit more about sort of what drew you to this story. Your book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Why was their story so important for you to tell? Tell me what drew you to it.
Well, first of all, it's a good story. Mm. It's actually three good stories. It's the stories of three young women who come to a particular kind of activism through very, very different avenues and for very different reasons. And documenting that passage was very important to me. And I think that's some of the greatest value of the book is just telling those stories. What drew me to the actual event was that I think it's a great work of art. It's something that has made people question their assumptions. It's something that's made people think. It's something that drew an outsized reaction from the society in which it happened. All of those are signs that it's a great work of protest art. And of course, the trial that followed, that can only be described as a witch trial, also became a part of that work of art.
Part of the work, right? Not that it was designed to be so, but it sort of became a part of it after the fact.
It became a part of the performance. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I want to ask you about your experience in Russia. You left, if I understand correctly, late last year, along with your partner and your children. You picked up your lives. You moved to New York. You're a lesbian. You're a prominent LGBT advocate. Give me a sense of sort of what pushed you. What was the final straw that broke the camel's back and compelled you to leave Russia?
It was very simple. They started talking, the parliament members started talking about passing legislation that would remove children from same-sex families. Mm-hmm. We have three children. We're, as you said, prominent and well-known as a publicly out person. So I didn't think they meant other people's children. They meant our children. In fact, they had mentioned us by name, and one of the leading so-called Orthodox activists volunteered to adopt our children. So the whole decision-making process was probably about half an hour, sort of from the moment we realized that this was actually going to happen, this legislation was going to happen, and I believe it's going to be passed after the Olympics, to the point when we realized we had to get out of the country.
I read a quote that you wrote, the only thing more creepy than hearing someone suggest that you should be burned alive is hearing someone suggest that you should be burned alive and thinking, I know that guy. I mean, has it really come to that over there?
It's come to that. I have watched people that I know, that I have known professionally and I have worked with, take part in this virulent homophobic campaign that has been unleashed by the Kremlin. And because the race for the biggest homophobe in Russia, which has become a stand-in for the biggest patriot in Russia, because that race is on, people are starting to outdo each other, and it's very quickly come to talking about the ovens.
Is there an easy, I'm sure it's not an easy explanation, but for people in the West, it's been a long and not always straight line toward respect and a kind of political activism that has successfully given members of the LGBT community rights and recognition and so forth in the West that hasn't happened yet in Russia. Why is that? Is there an easy explanation for that?
It's not exactly that it hasn't happened yet. We were going in the same direction. We were quite a ways behind, partly because of the Soviet legacy. But, you know, it felt like things were getting better. And certainly, if I spent the 90s being the only publicly out person in the country, that wasn't the case in the last decade. Suddenly, it was like time shifting into reverse. And basically, what has happened is that Putin has declared war on modernity. He thinks that the world is against him. The West is against him. He thinks that the West inspired the protest movement. And the best symbol, sort of the easiest to understand symbol of the West are LGBT people. Mm-hmm. They're clearly foreigners. They're clearly enemies of the people. And they're sort of the best target. We're also the one minority that they thought they could beat up on without the world reacting. So the very large international reaction up to this point has come as a surprise to the Kremlin.
Speaking of that, a lot of Western leaders, including President Obama, to return to the Sochi Olympics, are choosing not to attend these Olympics. What's the impact of this, and how is it being perceived in Russia?
You know, first of all, I think it's a great thing that this has happened, because regardless of what the impact is, regardless of even of whether there is a backlash, I think that taking a moral stand in the face of a campaign like the one going on in Russia and saying basically it is wrong to sit down in the VIP box with a dictator who's inciting violence against his own people. That's the morally right thing to do, and I'm really glad to see a number of Western leaders taking that moral stand. So as for the reaction, I think the different people are reacting differently. It's a very polarized society. So the people who watch television, the people who have been brainwashed, there's no other word for it, by the homophobic campaign that has been going on television for the last 2 years, I think they see it as exactly what they're told. This is another Western attempt to influence Russia.
That's Masha Gessen. She's a journalist and the author of the new book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. She'll be speaking at Brandeis University tonight at 6:30 p.m. You can find details at radioboston.org. Masha Gessen, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Hey up, boy,
finally today, we want to end our program remembering Pete Seeger, the great folk singer, banjo player, and songwriter who led an American folk revival, died yesterday in New York. He was 94.
Seeger was more than a musician and folk singer. He was a political activist who believed in the power of music as a force for good.
He sang for the labor movement in the 1940s, for civil rights and against the Vietnam War in the 1960s, and for a variety of progressive causes throughout his long life.
He was a mentor to a generation of singers, from Bob Dylan to Joan Baez to Bruce Springsteen. He even had a brief connection to the Boston area.
He attended Harvard with plans to become a journalist, and he founded a radical newspaper. But he dropped out after 2 years and moved to New York, where he immersed himself in the local blues and folk scene.
So we'll end today with Pete Seeger. Here he is in 1955 with his group, The Weavers, singing a version of the Zulu song, Wimowe.
Rest in peace, Pete. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.